Epilogue. Wandering Ghosts. On a sunny July afternoon in 2010, I stood amid a solemn crowd of people gathered in the intense California heat. Some of them were dressed in suits and ties, others in casual attire. A few had come in military uniforms. There were some somber words, a three-volley salute, and then Jamie Henry's coffin was lowered into the ground. I came back to the same spot early the next day, alone now, contemplating the freshly turned mound of earth in the crisp morning stillness, and my thoughts ran back to the first time I had met Henry in person almost 5 years before. We had arranged a visit at his home, a cozy house with a white post and rail fence around it, nestled in the foothills of the Sierra Nevadas. Arriving, I knew that I'd found the right place. Henry had hung a fluorescent pink ribbon from a tree in his front yard to catch my eye, and it had done the trick. But when he opened the door to me, I was shocked. I had expected him to be much larger, larger than life, actually. That's what happens, I suppose, when you live with an oversized idea of someone for years before meeting him. The idea of a rare man with the courage to step forward, ignore threats, and put names to murderers, the courage to stand up for women and children gunned down in a hamlet halfway across the planet, a distant place to which no Americans had ever given a thought unless they'd walked through it with weapon in hand. Unconsciously, I guess I'd assumed that one had to be physically imposing to exhibit that type of bravery. But Henry wasn't much taller than me, and I'm no giant. He was leaner than I expected, too. His hair had gone white at the temples. His face was weathered and well-lined. He had what you might call a rugged look, a mountain man appearance, but without the bulk or the beard, and with icy blue eyes that were more kindly than steely. He sat me down at his dining room table, and we began to look over the phone book-sized stacks of documents I had brought, several reams of photocopied Army files. These were the records of the 3.5-year inquiry that Army investigators had conducted into Henry's atrocity allegations, following up on his sworn statement about a string of brutalities that had culminated in the massacre of some 19 innocent civilians 6 weeks before My Lai. I knew Henry's case by heart by this point, but he himself had had no idea that these files existed until I'd called him up out of the blue. Now he saw that dozens of other soldiers from his company, fellow witnesses to the killings, had talked to Army investigators as the Vietnam War wound down. Veteran after veteran had told the investigators the same basic story. 19 or so women and children rounded up and held under guard while an American officer went looking for volunteers to carry out a superior's orders to kill anything that moves. The Army had never bothered to tell Henry, let alone the American people, that it had established that what he'd said was true, nor had it taken any action. Not one man was ever jailed, disciplined, or even charged with any crime in connection with the massacre. The entire investigation, so seemingly thorough and meticulous, had been carried out for no discernible reason at all. Henry and I talked for most of that day. We spoke about his memories of the massacre and the other atrocities he'd witnessed, about the threats he'd endured from fellow soldiers when he spoke out against their brutality, about his efforts to force the Army to investigate, and his long struggle to get the American public to listen. He seemed calm enough throughout the conversation. Only later would he tell me that, after I finally left, he had stayed in his chair for an hour, shaking uncontrollably. Jamie Henry was not the only person I met while writing this book whose memories of the war proved too vivid, too excruciating, even several decades after the events. There were so many others. I will never forget, for instance, my interview with Ho Thi A, the survivor of the 1970 massacre in the tiny rural hamlet of Le Bac. In measured tones, she described for me how, as a young girl, she'd taken cover in a bunker with her grandmother and an elderly neighbor, scrambling out just as a group of Marines arrived, and how one of the Americans had then leveled his rifle and shot the two old women dead while she watched. She told me her story calmly, collectedly. It was only after I moved on to more general questions about the hamlet that she suddenly broke down, sobbing convulsively. There was nothing I could do to comfort her. For 10, 15, 20 minutes and more, despite all her efforts to restrain herself, the flood of tears kept pouring out. In Vietnam, where the lives of the deceased are believed to be inextricably intertwined with those of the living, it is thought that those who die a bad death may be forced to suffer as wandering ghosts, trapped in a limbo between our world and the land of the dead. In this shadow land, they forever re-experience the violence that ended their lives, unable to attain peace until the living truly acknowledge them and the fate they suffered. The idea of such wandering ghosts is an unfamiliar one for most Americans, but we should not be too quick to dismiss it. The crimes committed in America's name in Vietnam were our bad death, and they have never been adequately faced. As a result, they continue to haunt our society in profound and complex ways. Despite the decades that have passed, despite the presidents who have attempted to rebrand the war or dispatch it to the dustbin of history, Americans are still in the thrall of a conflict that refuses to pass quietly into the night. Never having come to grips with what our country actually did during the war, we see its ghost arise anew with every successive military intervention. Was Iraq the new Vietnam, or was that Afghanistan? Do we see light at the end of the tunnel? Are we winning hearts and minds? Is counterinsurgency working? Are we applying the lessons of Vietnam? What are those lessons, anyway? The true history of Vietnamese civilian suffering does not fit comfortably into America's preferred post-war narrative, the tale of a conflict nobly fought by responsible commanders and good American boys who should not be tainted by the occasional mistakes of a few bad apples in their midst. Still, this is hardly an excuse for averting our eyes from the truth. For more than a decade, I have combed through whatever files I managed to locate, searched out the witnesses who remained, and listened as best I could. What I've ended up with can offer, I hope, at least a glimpse of the real war, the one that so many would like to forget, and so many others refuse to remember. This has been a Highbridge audio production.